The headlines this hour. Iran's parliament overwhelmingly approves a bill aimed at tackling sanctions in what is described as the first practical response to the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist. The UN appeals for a record $35 billion to provide aid in 2021 as the coronavirus pandemic leaves tens of millions of people in crisis. And OPEC members reach a broad consensus on the need to extend oil production cuts for 3 months if their allies also support such a move. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iranian lawmakers have overwhelmingly approved the bill aimed at tackling sanctions imposed on the country. The bill requires the government to pursue uranium enrichment up 20%. It also calls for increasing stockpiles of low-enriched uranium. The bill calls for making use of advanced centrifuges, namely IR-6 and IR-2M types. Iranian lawmakers pushed for the bill following multiple rounds of sanctions that the U.S. imposed after it withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. Under the deal, Iran had agreed on curbs on its nuclear program. The bill follows the Friday assassination of eminent Iranian nuclear and defense scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. An informed source has told Press TV that the bill is Iran's first practical response to the assassination. Political commentator Tohid Asadi says a serious lack of commitment by the West has led to a new course of action in Iran.
Truth of the matter again is that the gap and the key gap and the key point of concern was a serious lack of commitment by the West, either in the United States or the European Union, that resulted in new courses of action taken by Iran. You just referred to the recent assassination, and if you just take a look at the response that we heard from the West and European Union in particular, it was very much, very much low in terms of the scale, and it was not as it was anticipated. So it is an instance of state terrorism, and we know, not as a matter of fact, but there are some evidence to prove that some specific players, including Israeli regime, are behind this attack. But when it came to responses, we had some very slight reaction pertaining to this specific matter. So it is in accordance with the same foreign policy of the European Union that follows the United States and follows pure interest and forgets about human rights and forgets about state terrorism and condemning these brutal, cruel courses of action taken by their own partners.
Continuing with that topic, Abdul Ghani Al-Khanjar is an activist human rights defender who joins us. Welcome. We're looking at proactive moves by Iran's parliament, which basically goes to almost the core of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, which is in line with the scaling back of Iran from its commitments. Now, the audience for this, first off, would be the European Union and countries that are part of that in terms of the signatories, Germany, France, and the UK. Basically, Iran is saying, listen, you guys need to get your act together and do something. One of our top nuclear scientists, in a list of many, have been assassinated. Will the EU act quickly?
I think so. First of all, let me condemn this coward and terror attack. We express our deep condolence to the martyrs' family and the brave people of Iran. I think the international community, the Security Council, as well as the United Nations, are not going to deter this evil Zionist regime from committing such a horrible crime. The only way to stop these savage and to stop this cruel crime is to get a harsh revenge from this evil Zionist and as well as the United States of America. I think that the Zionist regime violates all the international laws because it is simply protected by the United States administration. It's good that the Iranian parliament is going to take a political movement and steps forward against these crimes, but the only way to stop this crime is deterrence, and is the best way to stop this cruel crime. Without deterring the Zionist regime is the best way to stop its violation to the international law.
Well, one of the things that will be a challenge in some respects is obviously getting the U.S. on board, because if Iran wants to see relief in, let's say, sanctions, the U.S. needs to be part of, I'm guessing, again, that needs to be part of this equation. At this point, you have maybe an outgoing U.S. administration headed by Trump, which some say is a lame duck president, and with the president-elect, once confirmed, to be the incoming administration. How can you get the U.S. on board? Because Iran is very serious about the motions that have been set forward today in Parliament.
I don't think that negotiation with the United States will stop the sanctions. Sanctions is used to put pressure on Iran. As Ayatollah Khamenei said, they have experienced the way of negotiation, and the result were these results: crimes, more assassinations of those prominent scientists in Iran. The European countries, the international community, the United U.S. administration is not going to stop the sanction. They want Iran to, they want to put more pressure on Iran. They don't want Iran progress to continue. They want Iran to stop its development, to stop its to stop all power, to get all power, and to stop its projects, development projects.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Abdul Ghani Al-Khanjar, activist and human rights defender. Many thanks. Well, Iran has once again vowed to bring to justice those behind the assassination of its top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The foreign ministry spokesman said that Iran will certainly punish the perpetrators of the targeted killing, as well as those who ordered it. Said Khatibzadeh added that Israel's role in the terror attack, with the support of the U.S., is undeniable. Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in a town near the capital, Tehran, on Friday. The foreign ministry spokesman thanked all governments who slammed the assassination, including Iran's Arab neighbors. Khatibzadeh said that only one Persian Gulf state did not condemn the assault. He was referring to Saudi Arabia. The EU describes the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as a criminal act, but stops short of pointing the finger at Israel for the atrocity. One EU lawmaker tells Press TV that the murder last Friday near Tehran was designed to stifle efforts to pursue diplomacy with Iran. Jerome Hughes has more.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaz is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights on which or for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States. But also, trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal?
Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The UN says that 1 in 33 people around the world will need humanitarian aid next year due to the coronavirus pandemic. According to UN officials, the figure will amount to 235 million people worldwide. They say that's a 40% increase from the number of people in need of aid in 2020. The UN says hunger, conflicts, and climate change have made the situation worse. It says there's also risk of famines in countries like Syria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Yemen. The UN is appealing for more funding by wealthier countries. It says that it has raised only half of the $35 billion funding required to reach out to those in need. Infections and deaths from the coronavirus outbreak continue to surge in Europe, where fresh restrictions are in place to stem the spread of the respiratory disease. Lockdowns and curfews, however, are inciting the anger of the citizens, who are calling for better financial support and policies to cushion the economic blow of the pandemic.
European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. Here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quandercare movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus.
Several European countries, such as Spain, Italy, France, Germany, and the UK, have witnessed demonstrations against the new rounds of coronavirus restrictions soon after they were introduced earlier this month. Although some of the countries are planning to ease the restrictions during the Christmas holidays, they could risk yet another spike in COVID-19 infections. But what is the key question here? What is the key challenge? Well, striking a balance between keeping the economy afloat and protecting public health. That has proved to be a daunting task. The prospect of a slow and incomplete economic recovery, as well as a growing skepticism in the authorities' capacity to handle the crisis, is adding to fears of civil unrest and revolt on the continent.
European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt, or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. Here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercare movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus.
Since the coronavirus hit France nearly 1 year ago, and with a second lockdown in 6 months, unemployment and poverty are rising dramatically in the European country. Chris Den Hond has more.
A new kind of the French population is falling into a state of poverty. That's the conclusion of a poll institute, Ipsos, the Observatory of Inequalities, and of important humanitarian associations like the Resto du Coeur and Secours Populaire. They sound the alarm. The health crisis caused by the coronavirus is provoking an unprecedented social crisis. A new kind of people stand in line today for clothes and food assistance.
More and more people are coming here, especially since 3 weeks, because it's getting cold. We have started distribution points for women and older people, and we see that more women and older persons are coming. Now we have also more and more young people, young mothers, and students, so there is more diversity in the people coming here.
Rachid Agar is the founder and responsible of this Open Table Humanitarian Association. Since long time, he is heavily invested in aid for people in need.
Those who had small jobs of 2 or 3 hours a day, they sunk. Everybody is at the bottom. We picked up many of them. They were on a tightrope and they tipped over. We see a lot of them.
1 in 3 French persons has now less income than before the COVID crisis. Those who still have work fear to lose their job. Mariette was a saleswoman. Her business closed during the first lockdown. Now she depends from the food distribution. She crossed the line.
These people emptied their savings. They consumed the last tin can before coming here to us. At the end, when they had nothing left, they came here and stood in line. We notice people who come here for the first time. The misery today is screaming. We hear it. Hunger is yelling. Before, hunger and the misery were silent and hidden. Today, people are not ashamed anymore because they are in a survival mode.
The number of persons who receive food aid increased with 30% since the COVID crisis. Old people are paying a heavy tribute in matter of health, but young people will suffer more from the economic impact of the COVID crisis. Half of the poor in France is less than 30 years old. Since the beginning of the COVID crisis and the two lockdowns, 1 extra million of French has fallen under the poverty line. That's a total of 10 million of poor people in France. The Bank of France foresees an unemployment rate over 10% for 2021. An increasing number of people are in need for food assistance and blankets, especially now in the freezing cold. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Even after Trump appointed bureaucrat Emily W. Murphy of the General Services Administration signed a letter enabling Biden to start working with federal agencies and prepare for a transition of power, Donald Trump has personally continued to resist conceding. What is he after with his bogus legal challenges of a rigged and stolen election? Can he really hope for a legislative coup? Is the contemporary United States a country divided not merely on political and ideological issues among its body politic, but more frighteningly along different conceptions of reality? Public intellectual Noam Chomsky sheds light on these questions with groundbreaking insights in this exclusive interview for Truth Out. Stay tuned, please, for this interview, which is published under the heading Noam Chomsky Says Trump Has Revealed the Extreme Fragility of American Democracy. Campaign continues to mount legal challenges to the electoral process, pushing outrageous falsehoods, while Rudy Giuliani has gone so far as to make outlandish claims of a vast global conspiracy to steal the election from the great leader. In your view, what is really behind Trump's legal challenges?
Speculation, of course, but I'll indulge in a bad dream, which could become reality if we are not on guard, and if we fail to recognize that elections should be a brief interlude in a life of engaged activism, not a time to go home and leave matters in the hands of the victors. I suspect that Trump and associates regard their legal challenges as a success in what seems a plausible strategy. Keep the pot boiling and keep the loyal base at fever pitch, furious about the stolen election and the efforts of the insidious elites and the deep state to remove their savior from office. That strategy seems to be working well. According to recent opinion polls, 3/4 or 77% of Trump backers say Biden's win was due to fraud, and the anger among Trump's base is tied to a belief that the election was stolen. Rejection of the legal challenges with ridicule may please liberal circles, but for the base, it may be simply more proof of the Trump thesis. The hated elites will stop at nothing in their machinations. Meanwhile, this strategy requires keeping the wrecking ball, Trump's symbol, actively at work. Do nothing to deal with the pandemic, even delay in providing data to Biden's team, while a top nurses' union warns of catastrophic death in the growing chaos, whilst our hospitals are knowingly still not prepared and the government is on vacation. Viewed through the lens of this vast strategy, if the pandemic gets worse, so much the better. Then local officials will try to impose restrictions and even lockdowns to control patriotic Americans, in line with the plans of the supposed communist-run deep state, leading to economic harm and intrusions on normal life. Meanwhile, Trump and his associates could abandon other normal governmental activities so that when Biden establishes what they describe as a fake government on Inauguration Day, the immediate problems will be severe and failure likely. On that day, which will live in infamy among the faithful, Trump might set up what he claims is an authentic government in Mar-a-Lago, with a Mitch McConnell Senate in his pocket and a furious popular base. The next step would be to make the country ungovernable, a speciality that McConnell has been perfecting for a decade, and that an accomplished demagogue like Donald Trump can manage reflexively. Everything that goes wrong can be blamed on the treacherous elites. Trump and associates might, as some have speculated, set up an alternative media empire, incorporating talk radios and other far-right media outlets, but perhaps not Fox Channel, which has shown occasional signs of disobedience. Then, they could come roaring back into power in 2022 to 2024, feeding on growing discontent. They would then be free to destroy the environment with abandon and maximize short-term profit for their primary constituency, impose discipline on what remains of government, tame the media, institute harsh authoritarian measures elsewhere, and continue with their abject service to their masters, the real elites, the very rich, and the corporate sector, the decision makers, as recent academic research once again establishes very clearly.
Trump's hopes for denying a Biden election win lie with a legislative revolt, that is, by overturning the certification process. Experts indicate that such an outcome has a very slim chance of taking place, yet the fact that it is even considered as a possibility surely reveals something utterly problematic about the way democracy functions in the United States of America. Can you share your views with us on this matter and discuss what it would take to make the democratic process in the U.S. actually democratic?
Whatever the validity of my speculation about the goals and success of Trump's strategy, the whole election reveals the extreme fragility of American democracy. It is amazing enough that someone whose malevolent decision to provoke an out-of-control pandemic has just killed tens of thousands of Americans can even run for office, even carry much of the country with him, and that the political party that virtually shines his shoes can win a resounding victory at every level apart from the White House. That's putting aside Trump's major achievements, driving to near-term environmental catastrophe and sharply increasing the threat of terminal war, crimes that scarcely registered in the electoral process. Trump's rejection of the election result is just the coda to his quite impressive campaign to accomplish an authoritarian takeover, with the executive purge, whilst his close associate Mitch McConnell converts the Senate into a joke, functioning almost entirely to enrich the rich, and stack the judiciary with young far-right justices whose task will be to impose the ultra-reactionary Trump-McConnell agenda for a generation. We have just endured 40 years of regression, the neoliberal regime, a bitter assault against democracy and the kind of society that can sustain it. An estimate of the monetary cost to the general population was recently given by the Rand Corporation. $47 trillion transferred from the working and middle classes, 90% of the population that is, to the super rich, the top 0.1%, doubled their share of wealth to 20% of the total since the Ronald Reagan administration. The Rand Corporation figures are a considerable underestimate. Tens of trillions of dollars more were transferred after Reagan opened the spigots for tax havens, shell companies, and other devices to rob the public. More were developed under Clinton's deregulatory mania. Reagan and his partner Margaret Thatcher moved at once to undermine the labor movement, setting in motion the campaigns to deprive working people of their primary means to resist the assault. The serious decline of functioning democracy is a virtual corollary to the radical concentration of wealth and dispatch of much of the general population to stagnation and precarity. There is no need to review the rest of the sordid story once again, but it is important to remember the deep roots of the undemocratic structure of the government.
Millions of Trump's supporters seem to believe that their leader actually won the election. In fact, there have been even signs claiming world knows Trump won. How do you explain this peculiar phenomenon?
It is also important to consider the devastating impact of the neoliberal regime on much of the country, with particular severity in rural areas that were also major centers of manufacturing. After steady growth for many years, employment in manufacturing sector declined from its 1979 peak of almost 20 million people to under 13 million 40 years later. The decline was in large part the result of policy choices, bipartisan investor rights agreements, mislabeled free trade agreements, which provided unparalleled protection and other rights to corporate power, while setting working people in competition with the most poorly paid and repressed workers in the world. That has been a large factor in the devastation of rural America, towns depopulated or abandoned, no jobs or hospitals or other services, general malaise and a justified sense of having been abandoned. That's hardly conducive to participation in the most advanced sectors of global culture. The source of the divide you mention are complex. The split, however, is very real. And it has major impacts as well. Right now, the country is in the grips of a severe pandemic. It was understood by scientists in 2003, after containment of the SARS epidemic, that another coronavirus was likely to appear. The cultural divide soon emerged. When Barack Obama took office in 2009, one of his first acts was to convene the President's Scientific Advisory Council to request them to provide a pandemic response plan. And they did. It was implemented and remained in force until January of 2017, when one of Donald Trump's first acts was to dismantle it, opening the most anti-science administration in modern American history, with consequences that we have seen on many fronts, and with effects on popular culture. The conflict of epistemologies is real. It is no simple matter to explain or to deal with it. The future will depend substantially on how this conflict is resolved.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Dispossession, the great social housing swindle directed by Paul Sung. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him is Claudia Webb, who is a Labour Party councillor in the London Borough of Islington. Now, Dispossession is a documentary that explores the catastrophic failures by successive governments that have led to a chronic shortage of social housing in Britain. The film focuses on the neglect, demolition and regeneration of council estates across the UK and investigates how the state works with the private sector to demolish council estates to build the land they stand on, making properties that are unaffordable to the majority of people.
They're going to regenerate it, which means total demolition. And when it very first started, it was a case of nothing will happen without your approval. Well, that was lie number one on day one, and it's never changed.
We've got councils of all kinds across London who are trying to demolish traditional council estates. They're actually destroying communities.
It was Mrs. Thatcher whose right to buy scheme was a vote winner for families like the Pattersons. She gave them the title deeds to their council house. They gave her tea in return.
Don't you think this is lovely?
The right to buy was probably the most popular policy ever introduced by Conservative government.
Housing is a fundamental human need, and it's one the market just doesn't seem to be capable of providing.
We should be building every year about 240,000, 250,000 homes, and we're nowhere near that.
I want there to be no-hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
Essentially, we've had successive governments that simply haven't seen the role for social housing, and they've been cutting it.
It's not seen as being aspirational, and aspiration is the key word.
last 10, 20 years, housing stock that used to be here is down, it's gone.
Access to housing in Glasgow, to social housing, is nigh on impossible.
They are tearing apart our community, brick by brick, and we're not going to let them.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a very serious problem facing this country, and it was a very moving and deeply personal documentary for the director, I believe, as he grew up on a council estate. And especially in the wake of the Grenfell Tower tragedy, this film comes at a very important time. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I was very impressed by it. I thought the first time I saw this film, I was a little bit concerned about how compacted it was, the amount of information it crams into an hour and, I think, 26 minutes. The second time I saw it, I was impressed by the amount of information that it did get in, the amount of ground that it covers, the fact that it covers all these issues from so many different angles. I mean, you're getting the input of the politicians who have to make the policy decisions that cause estates to be built or to be knocked down. You're also getting the input from people on the ground, residents of the estates, who have a very different take on it. So I'm a big fan of this film.
So as you say, this documentary, it was very dense, packed with information, statistics, and usually these films are quite difficult to watch. So do you think the director was successful in conveying his message then?
Yes, because in part I think that it makes its points pictorially. I mean, it is very crisply shot, and it's one of those situations where I think if we're walking down a street anywhere, this is the kind of issue that hits you smack in the face. You know, we could go for a walk around the studios here, and we would see 3, 4, 5 luxury flat developments, springing up everywhere. But we'd probably see more homeless people than we'd see social housing developments going up. And the film is very acutely attuned to what is actually happening at street level, and it shows you the disrepair that many estates have fallen into, and it contrasts that with the slightly sort of eerie gloom of these new developments going up that don't seem to be inhabited by anyone because no one's got the money to afford to move in there.
And Claudia, if I could turn to you now, as someone who works closely with this issue, is the social housing crisis in this country as bad as the documentary suggests that it is?
Well, the documentary highlights quite well, actually, the state of play of council housing and council house in the UK, and in particular, actually, in London, and the sort of the dilemma that councils face as against the sort of the notion of community, the notion of identity, and the notion of neighbourhood, the concept of fairness. Right at the very heart of an urban inner city area, and what does a home mean? And it begins to explore what that means today, as against what it should have meant, and what we've got really in terms of what the documentary is portraying and what the film is portraying is this whole issue of council homes being sold off for profit. Council land being sold off for profit, and exposing really a reality and dichotomy of huge waiting lists, homelessness, and yet council homes being sold off for profit against that sort of waiting list, and then what happens to communities and what happens to neighbourhoods. It's a stark contrast, and the film has really brought home and brought out the realities of the dangers of making the wrong decisions.
Indeed, and this documentary, one of the key messages is that a home is a right and not a privilege.
We need to offer housing to people at lower rates than full market cost. And the way historically we've done that is we've built social housing. We've provided housing to people that the state has some direct investment in, on the premise that not everybody can afford to rent a full market cost or indeed afford to purchase their own home.
The current government has slashed investment in social housing so much that the housing crisis can only get worse. The only solution is to invest in social housing again, both through local authorities to build council homes and through housing associations to build social homes, in the way that the post-war government invested. And they need to be homes that people can afford, not homes that are called affordable, which are not.
if you build a council estate and people move in, those people pay rent to the local authority. After a few years, then the cost of building has paid for itself. Whereas if you have private rent, A, it's a lot more expensive, B, that money goes straight into landlords' pockets and doesn't get reinvested. It's a really good economic model, and it also points to the fact that housing should be a right for everybody.
In this documentary, we learn there's various misconceptions about social housing. Claudia, if I could ask you, why is there a need for social housing?
Well, social housing is really relevant in a local area where people, in a sense, can't afford to live in a home unless housing is provided that meets their ability to pay for that home. And in a sense, what we've got is a growing population and basic need. And a basic need is a roof over your head. And if councils are deprived from building homes, then in a sense, what you've got is demand outstripping supply. And really what the documentary highlighted by showing clips of Margaret Thatcher, it highlights Thatcherism and the policies of Thatcherism, which at the time
which
was
the right to buy scheme.
Which was one, the issue about right to buy, but two, under Thatcherism, they stopped councils from building council homes. Councils used to be a machine for council homes. So within local authorities, you not only saw the production of homes, but you also saw the architects, the builders, the quantity surveyors, all of the professional skill sets located within a council. Those skill sets have long gone.
And thank you for that point and shedding light on the need for social housing. And Mike, if I can turn to you now, we learned from the film that there are various stigmatisms about social housing. What are they? So what are some of these stigmatisms?
Well, one of the issues that the film addresses very well is the recent rise of TV shows like Benefit Street and things like that, where people who live on housing estates are, you know, it's these places are called sink estates, and you know, there's a certain stigma that goes with that. But there's a portrayal of people who live on estates as feckless and, you know, alcoholic, and you know, someone who's
scrounging.
Exactly, that's the kind of show. And these shows are very cheap to produce, like all reality TV, very cheap to produce, can get syndicated and make a TV channel or production company lots of money. What they actually give back to a society, a country, a community, very little. It's, you know, to stigmatize the people who appear on these shows and people who live on council estates in general. And I think part of that is because these shows are made by people from outside those communities looking in. And it's often, as the film suggests, people who actually live on council estates, they have a community, they have a life there, they know where they're going, they know, you know, where their house relates to other people, the people who live next door to them. And it's not a sink estate. It's they're not circling the plug hole. You know, they're getting by. These places are functional, but they're being depicted in such a way as to suggest that they're not, and that they need knocking down.
We're going to continue this discussion in the next part.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
In his first public speech following Labour's landslide victory in 1997's general election, Tony Blair stood on the Aylesbury estate in South East London and vowed there would be no forgotten people in the Britain his party wanted to build. 20 years later, residents of the Aylesbury might wonder what happened to New Labour's bold vision of the future. Since 2001, campaigners have fought against Southwark Council's plans to regenerate the estate. The council argued that the Aylesbury needs to be demolished due to the high cost of essential repairs. Campaigners claim that the council allowed the estate to deteriorate in order to facilitate its demise and justify a £1.5 billion redevelopment project.
So we saw Tony Blair there. And Claudia, I have to ask you, why didn't Blair fulfil his promises?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that when in 1997 Labour came into power in the aftermath of Thatcherism, in the aftermath of councils not
being invested in to build council housing. And, you know, one could have wished and hoped that the new policy of Labour would have been to enable councils to build council homes again. A good council will build good quality homes, and with the resources and the investment, will invest in the stock that it has. But equally, if designs aren't right, and you know, designs for their time aren't always fit for the future, and you then need to think about how do you make that housing stock work? How do you make it livable and continue to be enjoyable? But equally, what's important is, and what I fundamentally believe in, is if you are going to regenerate an estate, then what you need to bring back is council housing. You regenerate the estate to create continued council homes, and that we shouldn't need to, as councils, go into business with the private sector and sell off the land and sell off the homes for profit. And that's what councils need investment, so they don't have to do that. Maybe that they weren't presented with was the investment that was necessary to rebuild council homes rather than engage in a partnership with the private sector.
So you're saying that the Labour Party, the new Labour back then, effectively inherited this crisis. But Mike, from the documentary I get the sense that the Conservative Party are much to blame, but do Labour share as much blame also?
Well, one of the strengths of the film is that it recognises that this is essentially a non-partisan issue. You know, everyone, whether you're of the right or of the left, needs a roof above your head. And I think it recognises, as much as, you know, Labour and the Conservatives like to play this fun game on Question Time of blaming one another for previous policies, there is a degree to which both parties are to blame, and this is why we're in the situation that we're in now. That yes, that right to buy scheme was, although a huge success at the time, has proven to have taken so many properties out of the public sphere and put them in private hands. But I think at the same time, the film says that, you know, when Tony Blair did come into power, not enough was done to counteract that policy. It was seen as such a sort of overwhelming success. What can you do? You know, well, you could build more houses, and I think that was one of the issues that leads to the situation that we're in right now, that we simply don't have enough houses for the people who need them.
And another, I want to talk about a different aspect of the documentary now. And one of the effects of the housing crisis seems to be the dismantling of the sense of community. I get this sense from the documentary that the film suggests that there were outside parties that were directly targeting and sort of dividing the community in order to conquer it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is, in some ways, what the film is talking about is the direction of the entire nation over the past 50 years. I mean, we're told very early on that a lot of social housing was built close to factories, close to industries. And of course, once those industries closed down in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the last decade or so, where do the people who live on those estates go now? You know, how do they pay their rent? And if they can't pay their rents, does someone come in and take their property away from them? So that it's raising bigger questions than just questions around housing. It's about, you know, who, you know, how much responsibility do councils have for the people who live in within their remit?
Well, we'll just have to pause there again just for now. I'll let you get back to that point, Claudia.
As the estate falls into decay, I believe it was a deliberate strategy of the local authority, because they saw the Elephant Castle at the time as a prime market for real estate.
I haven't got all the details on the Hague, but my understanding is that some of the social rental properties will be built in another part of the borough. But again, it's around the fact that if we are going to take down a certain number of social rented properties, it's about making sure we're re-providing that, actually re-providing more for the same level of rent.
For the demolition of 9,000 plus council homes and their replacement with luxury apartments costing £600,000 and £700,000 as an entry price, was their answer to the problem. That's no answer to the 9,000, 10,000 tenants that were living in secure accommodation at the time that are now dispersed across London, and many dispersed outside of London.
People who benefit from the housing crisis are, of course, property developers. They want to have the densest housing possible. And the best way to make dense housing is to build luxury apartments and to make it look like, you know, you're building a tall tower block, not to house many families as they did in the 60s and 70s, but to give a really slick community lifestyle.
Now, before we went to that clip, we were just talking about the notion of dismantling of the community by the outside parties. Claudia, did you agree with what Mike said?
Well, I mean, I have a different take on it because obviously we're in, my context is London, and I can see that in areas like Newark, in Nuneaton, for example, which had a coal industry, that if you create homes around a particular industry and then that industry disappears in terms of the mining industry, then you are left with homes and people without access to meaningful work. That's not the case in London. What you've got in London is a total land grab. It's a disgrace, really, in terms of a total land grab by big developers who are basically capitalising on the opportunity that is presented by the lack of inability of councils to build and invest in homes. The policy of not allowing councils to build homes, that is what's been problematic, because it's been over decades and not over a few years. What we have now in places like my own borough, where we have a good council that is building good quality homes, we bucked the trend and we sought to build council homes, and we sought to find ways to do that and ensure that we do not sell off council land. But where we have planning, where we give planning permissions to the developers where they've got their own private land, what unfortunately has been created historically over time is the notion of poor doors. We have a policy of 50% of that must be affordable. Affordable meaning, you know, social rent properties. And what they do is they build that integral to the development, but they build it on the side or at the back, and that's where the creation of poor doors happens.
Of course,
you're in
Jeremy Corbyn's borough, and he's pledged to end the housing crisis. But I want to talk about this notion now in the film of social cleansing, which seems to be a contentious, controversial term, which means that low-income workers are being driven out of the capital, London, because of the soaring rents and the interests of corporations, of course, and real estate agents. What do we learn in the film about this?
The film's very good on gentrification and how neighbourhoods have changed rapidly over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, social housing is of less concern than attracting middle-class renters with lots of disposable income who can afford coffee and hummus and all the treats of living in the inner cities. But you know, there is a degree to which housing policy seems to have been skewed specifically, almost exclusively, towards that particular demographic. And of course, that, you know, drives out people who are originally living there. And you know, that's one of the many big issues that this film addressed.
Well, part of that was, you know, the whole huge banking crisis that happened. You know, what happened after the banking crisis was in London, then. That, you know, London's property market was then used as the place where people invest. And so what you've got is overseas investors purchasing land and property, never ever living in those properties and creating a this and them scenarios and situations. What is a disgrace is when it's set against that. So you've already got that as a problem going on. Set against that is when councils have got land and homes in council control. What is a disgrace is councils then selling that off in some kind of partnership with the private sector.
It is such a complex issue.
It is.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time in this program. And just final 30 seconds to Mike. Would you recommend this documentary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're now in a situation where the Evening Standard can run a front page about house prices going up as though that's some great triumph. To me, it looks more and more like a tragedy, and this film absolutely reflects that.
Well, thank you very much for your time and joining the show. And I'm afraid that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.